I'm Tim Malley. I'm a fellow at the Meta Lab, and this is Melissa Gira Grant. I've learned a lot by paying attention to Melissa Gira Grant, her unsentimental and nuanced writing about sex work, with an emphasis on work, nicely pulls away from the moral panics that typically typify both those attacking sex workers and those who ostensibly are trying to save them. She's a writer and freelance journalist covering tech, sex, and politics in the streets and everywhere else. She's got a whole list of great publications she's written for in her latest book, Playing the Whore, The Work of Sex Workers, which came out in 2014 from Verso, challenges the myths about selling sex and those who perpetuate them. But this talk's not about that. This talk is about her next book, an exploration of the birth and death of the American Red Light District and what it can teach us about sex, cities, femininity, individuality, and technology. And in particular, I think it's worth thinking about how sex workers often become early adopters of new tech and also canaries in the coal mine for police action and freedom of speech issues around new tech. Melissa Gira Grant.
Thank you, Tim.
Thank you, everyone, for having me. Thank you to the public health folks who came also. I didn't expect that, but that's very much what I draw from in my understanding of sex work, and certainly a huge part of informs my analysis. So my book that just came out this year, Playing the Whore, The Work of Sex Work, is very much labor-focused and talks a little bit about the internet and talks a little bit about the history of sex work in the United States. That book has much more of a global focus, and it really addresses labor rights and human rights. This talk takes a little bit more of a specific turn to the United States, looking at the last 100 years of sex work in the United States. I'm going to use some different terms when I'm talking historically about sex work in the United States. So the term sex work itself actually wasn't originated until 1978. The story goes, there was a conference about pornography and feminism in the Bay Area, and a sex worker activist named Carol Lee attended the conference and saw that one of the panels that she wanted to attend was called the Sex Use Industry. And she raised her hand and said, you know, can we change the name of this? This actually sounds kind of othering. This sounds kind of like saying like people are being used, and it doesn't really give a sense of their agency, their power, their decision-making, their choice, their consent. And the room agreed. This room of mostly anti-prostitution feminists said, let's change it. So what do you want to call it, Carol? And she said, can we call it the sex work industry? And they said, great. So that is the birth of the term. But when I'm talking historically, when I'm talking about like the 1890s, for example, I'll be using terms like prostitute and prostitution, even though today many people might not use those terms to describe themselves or what they do. And I opt to using whatever terms people use to describe their work, whether that's sex work, whether that's escorting, whether that's stripping, whether that's camming, whether that's prostitution or hooking or hoeing. Like, there's so many different terms here, but the bottom line is I regard people's self-identification as what matters most. So if you want to follow along, that's my Twitter name and my website and my email address, and that slide will come up again at the end. So does anybody in the room recognize this image? Has anyone seen this image before? Have you seen this image before? This is actually from New Orleans, from 1912, and it's a photograph of a woman who worked in, at the time, what was New Orleans' legal prostitution district called Storyville. And the photo was shot by a photographer named E.J. Bullock. He didn't have a huge career as a photographer. He shot a lot of boring, predictable landscapes, but at some point in 1912 decided to shoot about 75 portraits of the women who worked in the legal red light district, Storyville. And the photos were hidden for a very long time. They didn't actually come into public view until the 1950s, when a photographer named Lee Friedlander found them and purchased the glass plates that they were printed on, which is some of the decay that we're seeing on the edges is from the photographic process itself. And the Museum of Modern Art in New York actually acquired them in 1971. And in some of the images, not this one, but in some of the others, the faces are actually scratched out. And it's not clear at what point that was done. It may have been something that Bullock did himself. It may have been something that happened after the fact as an act of censorship. And it's also not clear why these images were even made. If they were made as promotional materials for the businesses, if they were made as portraits to show the women in their non-work life, like, it's very hard to tell from an image like this if this is somebody who's relaxing after a shift, if this is somebody who's just hanging out in the front parlor of a house. You know, we don't even know her name, and we don't know the names of many of the people in the Storyville portraits. And why this portrait is so fascinating to me is it's really some of the only material evidence we have of a very brief time in American history, from the 1890s up until World War I, when we had legalized red light districts in this country. And there's a reason that they came in so early in our, or so recently in our history, in the 1890s, which is at the substance of this talk. But this photo, for me, is something that, it's fascinating that it's like even acquired by the MoMA, that it has any kind of reputation of being like a work of art worth holding on to. To me, it's, you know, it's a beautiful image, but it's also a very kind of trace element of this history that we ourselves don't even teach ourselves. And the other reason I love this is some of the ways that we continue to talk about prostitution and sex work seem like they're drawn right from the moment when this photo was taken. These rhetorics of fallen women, of women who are injured, of women who have gone through some kind of trauma just by being associated with selling sex. And this is a very defiant image. And so even though this image is coming from a time when that kind of ideology is taking root in this country, that women must be saved from selling sex and saved from their existence, this woman looks completely at ease with herself. And I love the look on her face, and I love the moment that it comes from. Storyville is really one of the only places in this country that we can rightfully refer to as a red light district. And the reason I say that, even though this is a term you might see if you look in history books, referring to ancient Rome's red light districts, referring to ancient Babylon's red light districts, this is when the red light district came into being, at least as far as people who are print archivists are concerned. This is the Sandusky Register. It's a regional newspaper from Ohio. And in 1894, this article appeared. And here's the detail. This is the first time that we know that the words red light district actually appeared in print. So, you know, it's certainly not the first time people ever uttered the words, but it gives us a good sense of like when this actually became a concept in people's minds. And what it's talking about isn't actually anything that people who sell sex are doing. It's not even talking about what people who buy sex are doing. It's saying the Salvation Army have come to Louisville and they are only going to be allowed to be in this part of town because presumably their business being in Louisville at all is to minister to women who are selling sex. And so it lays out where they are confined to, because those areas are also the areas where women who sell sex are confined to. It's something that, even in its origins, has very little to do with the people who sell sex, and it has everything to do with the people who appoint themselves as the regulators of the sex industry. And the press, of course, does their job of using this terminology and sharing it. But, you know, we would be remiss in thinking that the red light district is something that is entirely in our past. This is an image from Boston. Not necessarily, you know, I grew up here. I lived in Massachusetts for 25 years. I know Massachusetts has a deeply puritanical reputation, but I don't find that to be a really useful way to think about sex in America and Massachusetts in particular. This is Cody Lee. We do know her name. And this was shot backstage at a club called the Mousetrap Cabaret in 1975. And it was shot by a photographer named Rosewell Engier. The reason this is significant is because in 1974, Massachusetts obscenity laws were struck down. And for a time, the adult bookstores and peep shows and strip clubs that had been sort of clustered in an area of town known as the Combat Zone, I don't know if people call it that anymore, but people remember that part of town. What would we call that part of town now?
Chinatown?
So this is the heyday of the Combat Zone as essentially Boston's legal red light district. Like, zoning relaxed a bit and allowed these businesses to be there. And, you know, one of my favorite stories about it, and Mayor Kevin White, who's the mayor in 75, visited for a midnight tour, and he brought reporters along to the strip clubs and go-go dance bars and all these various businesses that kind of called that area home. And he's sitting there with a bunch of strippers and reporters, and his quote to the press was, "My idea of a city has room for these places." And I cannot imagine many mayors having the balls and the honesty to say something like that right now, whether or not they believed it. But this is Cody Lee, and I'm glad that we know her name. And I have found this image digging through old stories about the Combat Zone, and there was actually a blog where someone wrote like a little bit about this photographer, and in the comments there were like hundreds and hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of comments from old dancers from that era who were trying to get back in touch with each other and sharing their email addresses. So I thought this is going to be a huge arc of my book if I can get in touch with these people and hear what this was like in the 70s. So, you know, when we think of the red light district in that era, we might not think of images like this, particularly this kind of double selfie, triple selfie thing going on with the photographer there. And they actually became friends. And I'm presuming since this image has been collected and is out there and she's still out there, that we would have her permission to share this. This is my most recent red light district trip. It's not nearly as fabulous as Storyville. This is the Fantasy Ranch, as you can see. The Fantasy Ranch is covered in aluminum siding, the same color as the sky behind it, just about. This is on Missouri Highway 50 between Kansas City and the Whitman Air Force Base. And it's just sitting there. There's absolutely nothing around it. Like, you're driving, it's blank. Well, not blank. There's, you know, trees and nature. Sorry, being a New Yorker. And then you see this thing. And I looked it up. Online. On Yelp, it has another name. It's called the Million Dollar Fantasy Ranch. And there are absolutely no reviews of it, but there are two little short tips. And someone who calls himself George T. on Yelp, he's actually a Yelp Elite user from Naples, Florida. He writes that his friend Tim Sully recommends BYOB and get 3-for-1 lap dances. And then there's another review from Tim S. from Wisconsin. I guess it's Sully. And who knows if they ever even, like, went to this place. Like, you know, they may have just been, like, online screwing around, like, leaving joke reviews for it at the expense of the only strip club in Warrensburg, Missouri, who needs these reviews to get anybody to go there. And if you look it up on Google, the third suggested autocomplete was, is Million Dollar Fantasy Ranch still open? So, too bad for Million Dollar Fantasy Ranch. Gentlemen's Club. So, and it's also a little more confusing because if anybody knows about the legal brothels of Nevada, which I won't talk about very much because it's sort of a different legal paradigm, they often call themselves ranches. And so to have this place that's like a strip club call itself a ranch, it's like a little confusing what might be going on here. There's just no way to even know what's going on here from the highway. You have to go online and figure out what's going on here. And that's sort of where we're at now in this country, where a lot of when we think of commercial sex, it's like there just isn't much physical space left for these businesses. There isn't much physical space left for these interactions. And all of them have to be successful commercially, to evade law enforcement, do most of their actual communications online. And that's one of the things that I'm really curious about, is how people find out about these places today, how they find out what happens in them, which many people would say the internet has changed that completely, and I think that's true. But there have also been technologies associated with the sale of sex for as long as sex has been sold. This is a project that nods back to ancient Greece, where it said one of the many classes of prostitutes were called the earth beaters. And they were named that because on their sandals, they had scored in letters the words, follow me. And so when they would walk, you would actually see this trail left in the dust, and then you could presumably follow them back to their place of business or their home. So as they walked, they would leave this trail behind them. And an artist named Noreen Letty, when she was in residence at iBeam in New York, reproduced these for the 21st century and swapping out leather and dust for silver platforms and GPS and Google Maps. So this was 2006, so this was, you know, quite primitive compared to where we're at right now with GPS, but what this project produced from this person walking around in these shoes was a trail of dots on a Google map. And presumably you could lock that information and only share it with a trusted circle of friends so that they would actually know where you were. And there was also an alarm system built into it. I mean, this is before apps. So, you know, if you wanted to do something like this today, they could be much more exciting. And she actually adapted a version of this project in a DIY for Make Magazine, which you can go check out and make your own version of these shoes. So whether it's, you know, words in the dust, whether it's GPS, in order to find sex workers, somebody has to be leaving a trail behind them. You know, if you go back and you kind of picture the red light district in your own mind, kind of the version of it that might exist in your imagination, you know, you're probably not going to see people actually having sex. You're going to see traces. You're going to see communication. You're going to see the neon itself. You're not going to see the movement of bodies. So the Storyville version of all of this is the Blue Book. These are fascinating. You know, brothels did absolutely operate out in the open, but you would find advertisements like this listing the women who worked at them, as well as very lavish descriptions and promises of what you would find on the premises. A lot of the houses had live music, which some people say that's where jazz was born, from the men who were playing piano and other musical accompaniment to the sex that was happening in the brothels. And some of these blue books include the disclaimer not to be mailed, because at that time it fell to the postmaster to regulate obscenity. So here's a sample. bad. Victoria Hall, a member of Miss White's club, as accomplished as she is beautiful, a form equal to Venus, a voice not unlike Patty. I'm not sure which Patty that means. Probably someone super famous in 1897. How could a more accurate description be printed? As in, what are they not going to say about her? And what more could be said? A lot, but you have to go and meet Victoria Hall to find out who Victoria Hall is and what she can do. Even then, there were limits on propriety. So, you know, moving ahead a little bit in time, we get something like this. I grew up with phone books. Did anybody in this room not grow up with a phone book in their house? Maybe. The first escort ad I probably saw was in a phone book, you know, flipping to the E section to see what was in there. And even what I saw was a little more behind the times than this. I don't think there were photographs. I think it was just clip art. But the lips clip art definitely ring a bell. And, you know, kind of these vague promises. It's blurred out a little bit because it was pretty terrible quality. If anybody knows who collects phone books from the 1980s and can get me some of them, I definitely need them to continue this project. If you have some in your garage, whatever. It'll be fun. Hopefully they held on to this particular section in there. The whole book. I mean, what's fascinating about this is, like, there's even credit cards on this. Like, I had to try really hard to find an ad like this that didn't have a web address on it. Because there was a moment when, like, this is literally all you had to go on, right? Like, you would be making this phone call, a shot in the dark. You couldn't have explicit conversations about what might be happening because to do so, you know, would raise suspicion for the people on the other end of the phone that you might be a member of law enforcement. And, you know, it's people are trying to conduct this business with the least amount of legal liability possible, which means that they have to put everything in the ad and hope for the best. And one thing that I love about this era of prostitution conducted primarily via phones is it reminds us that this, you know, a call girl couldn't have ever existed before there was a telephone. Or like a call girl was invented because we had telephones that were invented. You could sit in a room with a phone and wait for your customers and not have to go out and find them at another venue. And it gave people a measure of independence, which is something that I think of when I think of the internet. Please don't take photographs of this slide. This is a complicated slide. This is an ad from Backpage from New Orleans, actually just from yesterday. I blurred out as much as I could to make it obvious the things were blurred. And that also this is a mirror selfie, which you see a lot more of on ads today. You know, people don't need anybody else to shoot photographs of them now. They can just do it themselves and upload it. This person might not have even needed a computer to create this ad. This could have been created entirely on her phone, which is also opening up you know, connectivity to online advertising for people who might not even have a stable home, but they do have a phone, and then they can make their money with their phone. The reason that I don't want this to be webcast, which it should not be, and the reason I ask people not to photograph it, is the same reason I'm going to take the slide out of the show after this, is these ads are meant to be ephemeral, and you know, this person has no opportunity to consent to me showing this ad to you, but I wanted to show at least a little glimpse of what an ad on Backpage would look like and what it might contain. And again, it's the same kind of euphemisms as you would find in the Storyville, you know, Louisiana known for a sportsman's paradise. And those blue books even were referred to as sporting guides back in their day. So this ad is, you know, online 100 years after the closure of Storyville. Storyville was officially shut down close to World War I in 1917. And, you know, this is a very dangerous thing to show because we live under criminalization in the United States right now. In some ways, law enforcement are much more powerful and they're certainly much more powerful in their ability to control prostitution and to criminalize people involved in selling sex and to incarcerate them and to give them criminal records that will follow them for the rest of their lives. In this era in Louisiana, before prostitution was legalized in Storyville, you found people getting citations, fines, you know, there are even records, if you go back to antebellum Louisiana, of prostitutes filing writs of habeas corpus to get their coworkers out of jail when they were being held too long. Like, they had access to the legal system in a way today that sex workers just don't have access to redress through the legal system. Most people are pleading out. So this is a very dangerous kind of material to have circulating for somebody. And it makes even talking about this complicated, because we don't know. Like, how can you talk about something if you can't give an illustration of it? You know, I have done sex work, and I don't talk about my own experiences in my talks because it's not about my own experience, but also because I just don't want to have to worry about that. I don't want to have to know what might be trailing after me after I leave the room. And hello to our members of law enforcement who are listening. So One thing to keep in mind looking at these three different kinds of ads is, you know, what drives all of these changes in advertising aren't just the technologies available for publication and distributing ads, whether you got it in your saloon or in your phone book or on your web browser, but also patterns of law enforcement. But even more than law enforcement, which I just talked about a little bit, patterns of urban development and gentrification. You know, contrary to what people in media and law enforcement believe when they talk about things like an online red light district, which you hear more and more of these days, it's impossible to actually conduct prostitution entirely on the internet. Like, you do have to meet somewhere. and we should not confuse advertisements for prostitution with prostitution. And we should not confuse people who publish ads with those who actually run prostitution businesses, which we will come back to in depth. Staying in the 1890s for a second. In the winter of 1899, the Everly sisters, pictured here, Ada and Minna, were headed to Chicago to open what they would call the finest brothel in the United States. And Karen Abbott wrote a fantastic book about the sisters called Sin in the Second City, which I recommend completely. And Karen Abbott says about this time in the United States, segregation was a term that referred primarily to sex rather than to race. The red light district is where women were segregated from the wives. They were regarded as impure and inferior, and so therefore having a segregated vice district was seen as a way to control and contain that. And they would be marked and therefore easily identified and avoided. By train, these sisters set off to Chicago, but before that they went to San Francisco, New Orleans, New York, and Washington. They evaluated all of the other red light districts in the United States before settling on these twin mansions that spanned 50 rooms at 2131 and 2133 South Dearborn Street in Chicago. And Chicago Vice Commission called them the most famous and luxurious house of prostitution in the country. So a rave review from Chicago's Vice Commission. When I think of those cities, San Francisco, New Orleans, New York, Washington, Chicago, Boston, by plane, those are all the same cities that women travel into the next century on something that was sometimes called the circuit. Big cities where big money happened and big conferences happened, and madams in each city would keep a black book of regular customers, but also men coming in for trade shows and conferences would fill up demand in the city, and they would be emptied in progression, and women would move from one to the next. And, you know, there's sort of an echo of that today, and I think some of the panics about big sporting events, or like whether it's the World Cup or the Olympics or whatever, that like, oh, all of these sex workers are going to come to town because of all this demand. And it's kind of true, but it's not really so true anymore because times have changed. But the panics haven't actually moved forward with the times. So 1899, the Everly sisters arrive in Chicago. 1999, San Francisco, Craig Newmark launches the erotic services section of his community listings website, Craigslist, an open, auto-refreshing market for sex ads that completely changed the sex industry. The erotic services section expanded with Craigslist itself, first to Boston, then to Chicago, so not New York, not San Francisco, what was already in San Francisco, then New York, then Washington. All of these major circuit cities, the circuit just shuffled, just like the newspaper classifieds that Craigslist went on to replace. You know, the all-weekly advertising sections where you would find these ads started to fall aside as well as those papers closed. The whole thing moved a bit closer to obsolescence, and the online ads started to take primacy. So what's significant for me about the time in which the red light district became codified in language, the 1890s, the Everly's day, in our marketplace and civic life and our law, it was a time when across the U.S., cities and states were engaged in their first major combat about how to regulate prostitution. And there's some lessons I think we can take from that for today. So the 1890s saw the first legalized, regulated commercial sex districts in major U.S. cities, but it also saw the first wave of state-by-state copycat legislation to allow them, kind of in the way that anti-abortion groups today, like kind of make a bill one place and just hammer it and try to push it through from state to state to try to find new ways to outlaw abortion. They can't go after the procedure itself, so they go after the other kinds of aspects, whether that's how clinics operate or the weeks at which you can get a procedure. So the version of this for prostitution in the 1890s, but again, continuing today, in the 1890s, we see these things called red light abatement acts. They targeted third parties to prostitution. Bars and saloons where prostitutes met customers, arranged business, hotels and rooming houses that rented prostitutes places to live and work. And I should add that, you know, in some cities, these essentially just became race segregation. They would go after places where they believed that, you know, men of color and white women shouldn't be meeting, that white men and women of color shouldn't be meeting, that obviously that had to be a place of prostitution. And you start to see women barred from saloons wholesale, because if they're there, they might be prostitutes. So there were a lot of consequences to this. But it was seen as a noble mission because we have to stamp out prostitution, which, of course, we all know they were successful. So at the start of the First World War, the Navy decreed all sex-related businesses within close range of military bases be closed. And their justification is a pseudo-public health justification. They had to protect enlisted men from sexually transmitted infections. So, of course, we know we wiped out syphilis in the military. So, you know, based on all the layers of fear and opportunity, whether that's urban development, disease, race, Storyville, one of those last remaining legal red light districts, was closed. In 1916, 47 cities had closed their red light districts. Washington, D.C. area prostitutes actually fought back. Others did. In Chicago, there were marches of thousands of prostitutes against the closure of the red light districts. This is a letter that Washington, D.C. prostitutes wrote to the New York Evening Journal. It says, knowing that public opinion is against us and the passing of the Kenyan red light bill is certain, we, the inmates of the underworld, want to know how the public expects to provide for us in the future. We don't want homes, which is in quotes, like rehabilitation homes. All we ask is that positions be provided for us, jobs. The majority will accept them. We must live somehow. We are human. So red light abatement comes in the 1890s. It had basically no impact on the amount of, you know, prostitution happening in the United States. It certainly didn't go away. And red light districts obviously persisted. But now they were controlled a bit more tightly by police, and the consequences were a lot higher. You know, moving forward to today, to Craigslist, you know, what I think of the biggest threat to the life of the red light district in the United States isn't just the law or even law enforcement. It's law enforcement in tandem with gentrification. It's the fact that we don't actually have these spaces anymore. You know, if you look to Times Square in New York and you think of Rudy Giuliani in the 90s, he didn't just need the NYPD to get rid of Times Square. He needed Disney to come in and repopulate Times Square. And then to finish the job, he needed Craigslist, which, you know, is maybe giving Craigslist a little bit too much credit, since they were far from the first website people used to buy and sell sex. In the mid-1990s, sex workers and customers were already connecting over Usenet, listservs, message boards led to online ad directories, which were a lot more formalized. One of the largest was called Eros Guide. It launched in 1999. For sex workers, the internet has provided the same thing it has for everyone in business: direct, continuous, and sometimes aggressive communication with your customer base. So as a result, the third parties now, they aren't saloons. They aren't the blue book publishers. They look quite different. You know, you pay a cut of your earnings, not to the agency who can afford to place an ad in the yellow pages. You can afford your own much cheaper ads online, whether that was free on Craigslist or a nominal fee on a site like Backpage. You know, in place of a madam to get you your customers, maybe you just hire a web developer to make a website for yourself. And through the internet, even if no one in your own private life knows that you're a sex worker, you can find support on message boards, on blogs, on Twitter, Facebook, and YouTube, where sex workers are sharing stories and building their own communities. So as illegal as prostitution remains, communicating about prostitution over the internet still occupies a questionable and contentious area. It's not necessarily legal or illegal. Speech is obviously protected, but it's not something you're likely to face charges over alone. But still, these online spaces operate with a wink and a nod. Those who use them try to avoid overt discussions of sex for sale. And so far, courts have sided with the website owners, protecting them from liability. They use a section of the Communications Decency Act, Section 230, which exempts web publishers from responsibility for user-generated content. And every time a law has been proposed to take down these online sites, they have, in states anyway, they have won on those grounds. The law has been thrown out as unconstitutional. So despite these legal protections, though, lawmakers and social reformers today, like their progressive era counterparts, are still going after sex workers' third parties. They're still trying to make business harder for sex workers. And, you know, in particular, they did zero in on Craigslist. Here's Craigslist CEO Jim Buckmaster with now Senator Blumenthal from Connecticut. In 2010, he was part of a campaign to pressure Craigslist to remove sex ads. There was a very contentious hearing in Washington. After they were successful getting ads off Craigslist, they realized, oh no, they've just moved somewhere else. They should have known that. They did know that. They didn't care. Who knows? You could drive yourself into a very dark place trying to question the motives of policymakers. But they then went after Backpage. So law enforcement now admit that these sites actually aid them in doing police work, you know, even in identifying people who may have been forced into the sex trade. Almost all of these sites now have some kind of hotline or ad or something that directs people to resources. And people who are doing health outreach to sex workers also use these ads to find people. It is the easiest way to find people, which is why they're super fascinating to law enforcement. It's at the same time as they're saying we love these sites because they help us find and track people, the National Association of Attorneys General have called for the closure of both Craigslist and Backpage. There's a new bill right now in the Senate called the SAVE Act, directly targeting ads that Dianne Feinstein, fan of the internet and free speech, of course, is one of the co-sponsors, as well as the senator from Illinois who described the Backpage owners as his least favorite whoremongers at a press conference in the last few weeks, which begs the question who his favorite whoremongers are. I don't know who wrote those remarks for him. I'm sorry. So it's a very complicated moment where people are trying to define what's going on these sites. And everyone has their own agenda. You know, campaigners and law, anti-prostitution campaigners and law enforcement want to describe what the sites are doing, not just as speech or communication or commerce or business, but as a crime. And I'm reminded here of a headline that an editor put on one of the first stories I wrote about Craigslist back in 2008, which is Craigslist CEO, not a pimp, just enormously helpful to prostitutes. So that is the crux of the issue to me. It's really like, why are you trying to describe a website as a pimp? Is a pimp a web publisher? Here's something that was in the New York Post recently. Hookers turn homes into brothels on Airbnb. Pimp my butt. You gotta love the New York Post too, because they're so consistent. But they, like, it. Where is a brothel? Is a brothel any apartment that anybody has put on Airbnb? What makes it a brothel? A sex worker walking over the threshold? Like, this is sounding like kind of like Old Testament. Like, you know, what. Maybe a brothel is something now that a woman who sells sex just carries with her where she goes, you know, and do men who sell sex do it in brothels? Because we tend not to apply this word to them. We don't have all of these fears in public campaigns about men who sell sex, even though men do sell sex. You know, where is the brothel now? Are we going to start talking about the brothel in the cloud? Like, God, you know, like, this is like a really... Where is the brothel in the Internet of Things? You know, like, are pimps and brothels becoming relics of the past? You know, now that the business is changing. Someone I love to give a hard time to, the Sudhir Venkatesh, I call him a stunt sociologist. He wrote a book about sex work in New York called Floating City. And I love this idea that he's still promoting that we've, you know, sex work is still in this floating world, even though we're in the 21st century, very obviously. And he gives you this kind of idea that where sex work is happening is this, like, fantasy place. It's, like, totally unmoored from the real world. It's, like, some secret place that only he has access to and nobody else does, and you need him to go there, which is very clearly not true. But this idea of, like, floating and drifting is worth digging into a little bit, despite Venkatesh. You know, the very first laws that were passed in America to target prostitution were actually not against selling sex, but against women believed to be selling sex. They would go after them for things like vagrancy, which also has a really, you know, complicated history in Jim Crow South as well. The idea of, like, these people shouldn't be here. We're just going to get these people off the roads who shouldn't be here. A woman walking alone at night, what is she doing? What could she possibly be doing? You know, I love that at a time we used to call those women tramps, you know, and thinking of, like, the very gendered nature of the tramp. This is something Kathy Weeks has written a lot about in her book, The Problem with Work. The idea that, you know, the tramp or the whore is somebody who is objectionable, not because of their low status or because of their sexuality, but because they're shirking work, and work is where we get our goodness. So, you know, the real problem, we told, isn't that these people have a problem making ends meet. It's that they've got no boundaries and they're going where we don't want them to go. So I want to go back to a tantalizing question from the beginning. Is the Fantasy Ranch still open? So the ultimate strip club list entry for the $1 million Fantasy Ranch has 56 reviews, an average rating of 3 stars. It's pretty good. On December 10th, 2013, a guy named KCJHawk123 gave the atmosphere 3 stars, the dancers 3.5. You can separate that out. And he says the BYOB thing is weird, but not a huge deal. So props to those guys on Yelp. They apparently were really there. May 15, 2010, there's a YouTube video actually shot inside the Million Dollar Fantasy Ranch, a guy named Rick Ryan, apparently the same elderly, bespectacled man who posted the video, who was in it interviewing a dancer at the Fantasy Ranch. Her name is Sarah. I'm not showing the video because I presume at some point in her life, Sarah will say, Rick Ryan, why did you put this on the internet and remove it? But she laughs when he's interviewing her and says her name. And she says, this is one of the best jobs you can have. And he says, oh, girl, I can imagine you in the bedroom. And she rolls her eyes, but like just a little bit, like not enough to totally break the thing. The next day, May 16th, there was a review of the Fantasy Ranch on the Ultimate Strip Club list. And it begins, strange times on Highway 50. People get very literary with their strip club reviews. So all of this interests me, this material production of these spaces online that has very little to do directly with selling sex, but like this presence that they have online that is breaking through all of the stigma we have to not talk about these spaces and to sort of make them real to people, make them places people could get into. It interests me because so much of it is happening between men. And that is interesting to me because as far as we know, men invented the red light district. So here's the story. I think it's true. I've repeated it to a ton of people by now. It's at least as true as those Yelp reviews. Theoretically, railroad workers, 1890s, when they left a shift to go visit a local sex worker or prostitute, they'd take along a red light, a signal light with them, and leave it outside the door. And the purpose of that was so if their boss needed to find them, they could make them come back to work. So red light has nothing to do with advertising prostitution. It has nothing to do with saying sex sold here. It's like, I'm blowing off work, boss, come and get me. It is absolutely about labor and very little to do with sex. So that explains why it's not until 1894 that we get the term red light district in print in the Sandusky Register. This red light, just like these reviews on the Ultimate Strip Club list, is a message that's exchanged between men. And we know that many times those men are also the police. So a little elegy for the red light district before we stop. We could say that peep shows and porn theaters and street level sex work, particularly those conducted in mixed use neighborhoods like Times Square, New York. And if you want to know kind of a definitive history or a very definitive personal history of the red light district in Times Square, I recommend Samuel Delaney's book, Times Square Red, Times Square Blue. These are mixed use neighborhoods. They weren't just there for sex. You know, look, you've got Howard Johnson's and burlesque. And so we could say these places are being displaced by online ads. But more to the point, like Times Square, the web sex markets are flourishing in essentially vacant spaces that were left in the wake of gentrification and policing campaigns that imperiled the sex businesses that also once called those blocks home. So these physical spaces may never come back again. And at the same time, anonymous sexual encounters are now increasingly mediated online through digital communication. And that mediation through the digital only magnifies the power of myth-making and fear-mongering and panic about what the online red light district is. It's so easy to peep into it. It is so tempting to think that we understand it just because we have a browser and so do sex workers. And all of that gives rise to this idea that like if we can see it now, it must be growing and expanding and somehow getting worse. Not that it's just simply nearer to us and that we have more traces available to us than just one photograph left behind of a brothel in New Orleans. There was a time also in the 18th and 19th centuries where there was this euphemism for prostitutes, public women, you know, when it was necessary to reference women who were presumed to be prostitutes without actually using that word. And I wonder all the time, you know, what is the public left for public women today? This is a map the FBI produced this month, 3rd in June, of Operation Cross Country 8. It's kind of like a horror movie. It's exactly like a horror movie. And they go out and they do these anti-prostitution stings. Regularly. This one netted the arrest of hundreds, if not thousands, of sex workers. All that they reported to the press is that they recovered 160-something minors. They didn't talk about all the adults that they arrested. The FBI knows this is a network because here's AeroSkyde. Like, really? Idaho? Montana? Maine? What's going on? I mean, like, this is... I don't know what's going on, but I think that this is really interesting. It's like this is the network, you know, and what the FBI director Comey said in a press conference after Operation Cross Country is the arrests and prosecutions are only part of what they're interested in. They said, we're using the intelligence we collect to identify a larger network. At the last day of Operation Cross Country in Mountain View, home of Google. There is a company called My Red Book, also much less famous than Google, but they had an online community for sex workers, and the FBI and the IRS raided them and seized computer hardware and raided their sites, and now there's just an FBI seizure notice on their website, and we don't know what they took in that. We don't know if they have the IP addresses of every sex worker and every person who went to that board. We don't know if they have their private communications that they exchanged. We don't know if they have copies of their credit card information, their IDs that they may have had to give to the site. But I will say that all of that information about someone's legal identity, that is what this new legislation wants to require websites to collect and make available to the Department of Justice. So if you want to take an ad out on one of these sites, you are now consenting to have all of that information about you in a database that law enforcement have access to whenever they want it for whatever reason. So it's very obvious to me that the future of selling sex in this country is a network. But then again, the future has been here for a very long time, whether that network was the railroads, whether that was the circuit. The sex industry reaches beyond bodies to this flickering of codes and signs and attractions that pass between them. It's the networks that are as interesting to me as the transactions themselves. Because selling sex has always required a vehicle for communication operating just out of view. And it seems to be what scares authorities, people in power, most of all about that, is the boundarylessness of that. There's always more internet. There's always more space. There's always more opportunities for people to evade all of these systems, that these people could be anywhere at any time, undetectable, and that's not something that power wants to abide. I'll stop there and take your questions. Thank you. And can someone remind me how much time we have for questions?
We have about 15 minutes.
Okay. Who wants to go first? Yeah. I was just seeing if any women have hands up first. Okay, you go first.
In Amsterdam, there's still a red light district. It's apparently legalized, institutionalized, promoted as a tourist attraction. Why do you think everything went so differently there than here?
I'm not sure that it has, because I'm hearing some of the same things about gentrification being one of the key things that's taking down the red light district in Amsterdam as well. And that's certainly true in other cities. So I don't know, other than continental Europe having different politics around sex, possibly. But I think part of it is that this is happening in London right now, where there's been tolerated brothels, and the Soho Redevelopment Group is moving in, kicking out people who've been in those businesses for decades, and saying that this isn't about morality, this is just about real estate. More questions? Yeah.
Who was that artist who had done the update of the Greek sandals? Because that actually sounded really fascinating.
Her name is Noreen Leddy. L-E-D-D-Y, and you can also go to the aphroditeproject.tv, and all of the documentation and how-to is there.
In terms of private social networks that we often talk about in this group, or technology for, is any of that entering into the sex work domain? And the technology of private social networks.
Sure.
Alluded to it a little bit, but
there is, and you know, there's two things going on. One is that they are often really lo-fi. So, you know, one group that I was a part of when I was working in order to vet customers off of a list of people who had been dangerous was a Yahoo group. Probably not the most secure place on the planet to be exchanging this information, but given what people had access to, you know, we were using that as a group of workers who all knew each other in one city to share private information with each other. I know that people are trying to build a replacement for MyRedBook, the site that the FBI and the IRS seized. And those are some of the questions they're asking is, you know, how do we do this in such a way that we don't just make ourselves targets? Like, I think that if you're going to have something like Noreen Leddy's project, for example, that map to protect people where they can have a trusted group of friends who could see their location on a map and where they are, you would have to have non-sex workers using it too. It would have to be mixed use, just like Times Square, right? Because otherwise you just make yourself a law enforcement target or a target for predators or hackers or people who have some ill intent to get that information.
That leads to exactly the follow-up question. Could dating sites overlap with virtual red light districts, or is there a class of dating sites that become mixed use in this sense?
I mean, there are sites that kind of are in that like sugar daddy category that say they're dating sites because they don't want to be seen as sites where commercial sex might be happening. I'm thinking of sites like Seeking Arrangement, and they're all of their subsidiaries who kind of pose as a dating site that's non-commercial, even though the drop-down fields include things like annual net worth and, you know, total net worth and annual income. So there are people already kind of playing in that gray area as a way to sort of say, oh, no, we're not a prostitution business. And then I think dating sites, I mean, I know as far as 2000, I had friends kicked off of Yahoo Personals who their ads were flagged as potentially doing sex work when they weren't, because the dating sites were fearful of having either that reputation or that liability or whatever that was. So, you know, could there be an open-ended Tinder where people are exchanging both free and commercial sex? Probably not. It would be really confusing for people to, like, negotiate those. Like, part of what's happening, why these sites are segregated, why these, like, advertising sites are segregated, is because people don't want to have explicit conversations about money that might incriminate them. So they are happening in a segregated space so that the assumption is everybody there knows community norms, that this is how that works. So it would be a huge challenge.
Part of the reason why pornography and also sex work, but specifically pornography, has led so many technical charges of, like, we're going to go with VHS over Betamax because that's what the porn industry went for or whatever else, is now showing where people are going to have the last vestiges of freedom online based upon where people are finding a place to have these exchanges. And so... That is mostly a comment, not a question, but how would you tie that back to the removal of the physical space?
I mean, the porn business, you know, you get VHS at the same time as you have those physical theaters being demolished, right? That's an absolute relationship. It wasn't just the format. And on format and kind of technological advances in porn, the absolute go-to person, as far as I'm concerned, is Georgina Voss. Who's in Brighton and is doing a book that's going to be out from Rutledge soon just about the IT workers in porn and how their work is organized and how they relate to their work and issues of stigma around being an IT worker in pornography. And she challenges that idea that porn drove technological innovation. She was tweeting the other day about finding a copy of Adult Video News, like the actual physical magazine, where there's a how-to for how to get on the internet for their readers. You know, so it's like, maybe they were, maybe they weren't. Like, I'm not totally sure. I think it's something we like to believe is true. I know that individual sex workers are often early adopters because they're always trying to go to the new place that isn't totally shut down yet. And they're trying to figure out how they can use it and be safe there. So I would sort of separate, like, the industry from the individual workers in it, which takes us a little bit outside the realm of porn. But porn is going through the same breakup where more and more performers are realizing they can make money just working, you know, making videos for someone else. That they have to have a supplemental income stream doing webcam shows directly, going direct to their customers. You know, I'm interested in how they're getting squeezed by this whole kind of rhetoric of, like, disruption and the sharing economy and all of this garbage. You know, I just did some reporting on a porn company that actually is producing shoots with unpaid people in them and offering it to them as a community exercise to come, you know, contribute. It's for Dissent Magazine, and the story is called For the Love of Kink, and it's about kink.com in San Francisco. So, you know, there's like some do what you love stuff happening within the porn industry as well. That's a little, I'm really concerned actually that, like, our idea that there's so much money and innovation in these spaces is a little overblown, and they're getting squeezed now by all of the same stuff that's leading us to things like Uber and Lyft squeezing out taxi companies, for example.
I was wondering if you could speak to how much the specific local city context matters for these things you're talking about. Like, San Francisco is a place with lots of above-board sex businesses and lots of above-board sex workers also is facing huge gentrification. Mm-hmm. But that might work slightly differently in places where the gentrification looks different. Mm-hmm. Chicago is not San Francisco, is not Atlanta, is not Miami. And there's also the sort of the world of suburban sex work, for example. So I was wondering if you could talk about those kinds of geography that might still matter.
Sure.
Even in a world of online publicity.
In San Francisco, when I was just there in March on book tour, I was talking to folks at St. James Infirmary, which is the sex worker health clinic there. I had the privilege of working for 2 years and doing their website and their social media. It was really nice. But they were talking about how there's, like, aggressive 24/7 police presences in the parts of the Mission, a very rapidly gentrifying neighborhood that's also sort of like a playtime destination for a lot of the new younger tech workers moving into the city, and so are some of the only people who can afford to live there. So they're drawing a connection between the increased policing and to protect the new people coming in. And what they're reporting is that it's the squeeze is really on people who already have the fewest resources. So if you can work indoors, you can work in a strip club, if you're working primarily online, you don't need to have any physical contact with people to get customers, then you can evade some of that police harassment. And San Francisco was unique in having actually a task force on prostitution in the 90s, where their recommendation was to decriminalize prostitution, which they did not do. They took it to the voters in 2008, and I think like 42% supported it, but it didn't pass. But what happened at that point was the police were essentially told, like, you know, free game on anybody on the streets. We just want to move them into strip clubs. We want to move them into peep shows. We don't want to have to see it on the streets. And that seems to be one very common thing in cities is, you know, do what you're going to do, but do it behind closed doors in a fancy, nice, classy place. And that's something that seems consistent. You know, the thing I'm most interested in as I dig into this city by city for this project is to look at histories of race and policing. You know, what is going on in New Orleans? You know, just contrasting San Francisco and Oakland, for example, and how the Oakland Police Department, corrupt and destructive as they are, you know, how they target sex workers in a different way than San Francisco's police do. And there's a lot there to look at. I think that, you know, who gets policed for prostitution in this country is overwhelmingly women of color, and that is not representative of the industry as a whole.
Mm-hmm. Along historical lines, as well, especially dance halls at the Turner Center where you have to pay for someone to dance with you.
Like a taxi dancer?
Oh, yeah, well, for men and for women. You know, I mean, dance halls like for Rudolph Valentino or George Raft, which would lead to them possibly having sexual relationships, at least for those two cases, with women.
It's so funny how, like, there are things like that that, like, exist in a moment, like a dance hall where you pay a dime a dance or something, that just don't have, they don't exist in the same way they do now. I've heard that there are still places like that in New York and Queens and like in more Latino communities and immigrant communities, but they're not like a widely practiced thing. So I would love to know more about that. And particularly with men. I mean, I feel like that's a space where, like, you know, we don't have like a real good history of men who sold sex. And I think because I see this, you know, even still today, like if you're a guy who sells sex, who's primarily in sexual relationships with guys, I feel like there's more home for you in your community than there are for women who sell sex primarily to men and are in straight relationships. Like there's just like something different about how men's sexuality is not commodified in our culture. And so male sex workers are a little more invisible, but also like a little more positively regarded. So that would be a great entry point into that history. And certainly the 1917 order that shut down Storyville had impacts in Harlem. And they used the same venereal disease, sexually transmitted disease excuse to shut down mixed race dance clubs there, too. I'm going to do a question from someone who hasn't asked one yet, and I'll come back to you. Yes.
Actually, it's more a comment than a question, yeah. But I did read the two links that were on the Berkman website, and they were really, really informative. And it was so nice to read something from somebody that was taking sex work and sex workers seriously, but wasn't moralizing and wasn't over-academicing the whole thing and was really making it accessible. So I just kind of wanted to thank you for that because it was, and I did check your book out from the library, I just didn't have a chance to read it before this.
Everyone tell their library to get the book because that would be
so thank you.
Thank you. Thank you. Okay, yes.
From listening to you describe some of the online spaces, it seems like that whereas sex workers have strong pseudonymity ideally, that a lot of the time the customers are afforded the luxury of anonymity, which allows them to have impunity, essentially. And since both people are interested in protecting their identity, would an ideal digital space have strong pseudonymity for both actors so that you would be able to have a persistent reputation for an identity that wasn't connected to you as a customer, so people could say, this person isn't a cop, or this person isn't weird, or whatever.
That's one of the things my Red Book had. Because it was primarily a community, customers would sign up under a username. Maybe they had multiple names. Maybe, you know, they didn't always use the same name for everything. But they had fixed usernames that they would post under. You could go and see how many years they've been posting. What kind of years, literally. The site was 10 years old. Like, what kinds of things they post about? Do they make disparaging comments about other workers? You could go see all of their reviews. You could message other workers and say, hey, have you seen username? Like, that did exist there, and that's the site the FBI now has who knows what about. So that's one thing. But I think that, you know, it's, there's multiple handles more, I think. That's one thing that makes that complicated, but I also think that that's, you know, the harm reduction strategy that people use to try to stay out of harm's way. You know, also many, many escorts and increasingly DOMs, to get an appointment from somebody new will require them to give over their legal name, require them to provide them with a phone number that connects to an operator switchboard or something to verify their identity at work, and do all kinds of online research on who they are based on that information. So once you actually try to make a transaction, customers are very rarely anonymous when you're talking about online escorts now.
Redbook being shut down, do you see the next phase is sites moving overseas to jurisdictions that are more sympathetic, or moving to something like Tor or something like that?
I mean, people are and should be using Tor now. The Electronic Frontier Foundation, to their huge credit, just published a guide for digital privacy for sex workers. I don't know anyone else who's, like, in the internet freedom world who's published something like that. So props to them and to Nadia at EFF in San Francisco for making that happen. So, yes, people are doing that. Encrypted email, even. Encrypted texts, if they can do that. Offshore. I mean, at that point, from what I understand, you're just putting more layers between you and law enforcement, who could still essentially gather that material if they wanted to. You're just making it harder for them. But some people are definitely moving their servers, at least offshores, even if they may still be incorporated or have bank accounts in the U.S. Their bank accounts are another thing. That my Redbook had $5 million in assets that the FBI wants to seize across bank accounts. And there's some questions about whether their banking activity triggered this investigation. Also, and there's, if folks want to go and do some research about Operation Choke Point to learn more about that, that's something that is a squeeze on banks that is trickling down to sex workers. And maybe perhaps a totally reasonable squeeze on banks. It's a form of, you know, it's a stepped up regulation of banks to try to ensure that they aren't engaging in fraud. But what it's turned into is profiling of people who may or may not be sex workers and having their accounts surveyed in different ways than the general public. I wrote about it for so long. You didn't get a question yet, yes.
So this isn't a public health question. I guess it doesn't seem appropriate for this forum. But apropos of this whole FBI issue, granted, sex workers are a highly marginalized group, and say the average person doesn't care what happens to them. But it seems like to me that if you're a member of the general public and you're looking at what the FBI is doing here, and you're looking at the situation of, you know, your personal control of your data or your information that's associated with your name, doesn't that seem like a demonstration product, you know, for what's going wrong right now with our society? I mean, it seems like it should be very concerning for everybody.
You would think in this moment where we're also having a much broader conversation about law enforcement surveillance and internet surveillance that this would be a point where people might jump on board and understand that sex workers, just as our old colleagues in public health 100 years ago sometimes used them as a test population to study, you know, how diseases moved in communities, and sometimes regarded sex workers as vectors of disease and not as individuals. I think that law enforcement sometimes look at them as vectors of, here's a group of people that we can test out some stuff on, and there isn't going to very much pushback. Or if they're the collateral damage to some policy that we want to pass, there's not going to be pushback from them. And sex workers are politically disenfranchised, and like I said, don't have the same access to recourse in the legal system that, I mean, very few people do, but they certainly don't. And I think that, you know, there's an opportunity for public outcry here that is desperately needed. And I think that what stops it from happening is that police can rely on the marginalization the sex workers experience from the public, too.
I mean, it just seems no less unethical to me than what was done with prisoners and studies of antibiotics, you know, 70 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
It's just astounding.
Yeah. And it's, you know, it's something that's shifting. I mean, may not sound like much in this room, but the fact that EFF is standing up on this, I think, is significant around the My Redbook case. And, you know, there were also 19 people in the House of Representatives who voted against this bill that I talked about that would force websites to comply with law enforcement preemptively. And they opposed it actually on the grounds of mandatory minimums that were included in the bill. It wasn't like a sex worker's rights defense, but it was around criminalization. So I think that's important to highlight, too.
What's the name of that bill that's
failed.
Oh, the SAVE Act.
Okay.
Oh, it didn't fail.
Oh, okay.
It passed the House. There were like 100, there was like 19 opposed.
It passed the House,
It passed the House, and there's a Senate version of it in progress.
Okay.
And I'm told the ACLU is also doing some work on this.
Sort of the opposite of the last question, actually. Have you seen either sex work or the new kind of moral panic, especially among evangelicals about human trafficking, have you seen that used by law enforcement or the intelligence community as a justification for pervasive surveillance in the way that narco-terrorism is starting to be on?
Absolutely, from the FBI. I mean, I never heard the FBI saying, you know, using things like gender-based violence as an excuse for law enforcement in quite this way. But, you know, when they went and arrested hundreds of sex workers and incidentally had contact with 160 minors, they only press released about the minors. And their framing of that was, we rescued these people from the sex trade, that this is always violent, this is always degrading. So they are picking up like that very classic outmoded messaging about, you know, this always being violent, that, you know, 40 years of sex worker rights organizing has taken us away from to a certain degree. But there's, I think, between the evangelicals who are interested in creating projects then that will do what the Salvation Army did back in the day to step in and rescue and rehabilitate these people, putting them into homes rather than just giving them jobs. I mean, law enforcement can't actually provide the response that people need if they even need to leave the sex industry. And the evangelicals see themselves as somebody who could get in there and do that. So that alliance is pretty real and about money.
I gotta cut us off.
Okay.
Thank you.
That's a shame, but thank you all.
You are certainly welcome to hang around.
I will, and if folks want to know the second best way to get my book after the library, you can go to Verso's site and buy a digital download directly from them. There is DRM on it, but your money won't be going through Amazon, and that's good for all of us. Thank you.